From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, one of the stars of the independent film world, Parker Posey. After making three mockumentaries directed by Christopher Guest, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, and A Mighty Wind, she's co-starring in his new film, For Your Consideration. It's a satire about mediocre actors in Hollywood. Also, two editors from the satirical newspaper The Onion, Joe Garden and Joe Randazzo, read a couple of their articles. The new Onion anthology is called Homeland Insecurity. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Parker Posey became well known in the world of independent film for her roles in Dazed and Confused, Party Girl, Kicking and Screaming, The Day Trippers, Henry Fool, and Personal Velocity. But she also co-starred in this year's big budget film, Superman Returns. She's been in three mockumentaries directed by Christopher Guest: Waiting for Guffman, a satire of community theater; Best in Show, a spoof of the dog competition circuit; and A Mighty Wind, a send-up of over-the-hill folk singers. Now she's co-starring in a new comedy directed by Guest called For Your Consideration. It's about a group of not very talented actors making a film who are stunned to hear that one blog is talking Oscars. The actors prematurely prepare for their nominations. The film the actors are making is called Home for Purim. It's set during World War II in a southern town where a family is reunited during the Jewish holiday when two adult children come to visit their dying mother for the first time in many years. The son is in the military. The daughter, well, she's a lesbian and she's brought her lover home, which does not please her mother. Here's a scene from the film within the film. Parker Posey plays the daughter. Catherine O'Hara plays her mother.
What did I do that was so wrong? Wanted my daughter to grow up to be a mama of her own with a house full of babies and a decent man to cherish and take care of. You just didn't want the boys around, Rachel. What kind of girl doesn't want to meet a nice fella? How many invited the best ones over, the ones whose daddies were professionals? There wasn't a nippish in the group. But you wouldn't have it. You wouldn't have any of it. And so you ran. You ran and tore a chapter out of your family's life. And a piece out of my heart.
I was screaming, Mama. But you couldn't hear me. And you couldn't see me for who I was. I didn't want your life. I didn't want to be in the kitchen with the brisket or the fish balls or the crab hock or the cool or go out with the boys that turn into men that I don't want to marry. It was all for start. I am not you, Mama. I am me, Rachel Fisher.
Parker Posey, welcome to Fresh Air. In the movie, you play an actress who's making, you know, a movie within this movie, and that movie is called Home for Purim.
Right.
And it's kind of set in World War II in a small town, and like, you know,
it's a period film.
It's a period film, yeah. And you know, the daughter and the son are home for Purim. And you're
That's
the daughter.
Right. And mother's dying.
And there's a bunch of kind of Jewish and Yiddish jokes in this movie within the movie. Did you need translations?
Yeah, I did a little research or talking to my Jewish friends. Chris Guest kind of got this idea. He was visiting Jamie. His wife was working down south in Georgia, and he's just hanging out, and we're hanging out in movies. There's not really much to do unless you're working. So he had a friend there, someone that he met down south, and he said, let me take you fishing. And he's like, okay. And then they're driving through town, and they're like, let's stop by the hardware store. And they stop by the hardware store, and he's like, hold on a second, Shlomo? And it's like these, and they were like, and he's like, what? You coming to? And there were these, Southerners speaking Yiddish. And he thought that was, he couldn't believe it, you know, this is happening. And so I think that's what gave him the idea. And Chris and Eugene wrote the Home for Purim movie, and I love doing that movie within a movie stuff. I think, and I play someone who's gay as well. I bring home my lover to meet my parents.
You're playing an actor who is co-starring in this period film set in the 40s, and when For Your Consideration opens, the characters in the movie are watching a 1940s film to kind of get in character. You know, to help get them in the spirit of 1940s
right.
movies. Did you do that too? Did you actually watch 1940s movies to see exactly what it was you were satirizing?
Yeah, I forgot which movies I watched, but, you know, when you get the call from Chris, he's like, you know, you're in this movie and it's, you know, that kind of acting, you know, and, you know, it's that thing, you know. So everyone kind of watched these period films and did their own version of it, and it was really fun, you know. It's just kind of a strange acting when you come into the door, someone's about to open the door that you're coming into, and then you do that kind of fake kind of stop, like, or surprise, you know. There are these different kind of like acting kind of things that people did in those movies, in those melodramas that's kind of funny.
What else did you take away from those melodramas?
I think it's funny that all the women in the 40s movies kind of seem gay, and the men as well.
In what way?
They're like Joan Crawford or Betty Davis. It was a time when the women were really standing up for themselves, you know, and the men were still kind of, you know, light in the feet and dancing. And there was kind of an intensity that was really, really great back then. Especially, you know, my character in the movie, Callie Webb, has written a one-woman show called No Penis Intended. So,
because she's been a performance artist as well as an actress, and this is her,
yeah,
her performance art downtown New York club kind of thing.
Well, this is in L.A. So
it was in L.A.
No Penis Intended was a one-woman show in L.A. And she has a improv background as well and a comedy background, but she's not very funny, and she's really angry.
What were some of the qualities you wanted to make sure you got to satirize when you did the one-woman show within the movie?
Honestly, I'm taking it seriously. I mean, I know it's funny, but as I'm doing it, I'm meaning it. And then afterwards, you start laughing, you know. And then you just, because you're thinking about these people for months. There's, you're developing empathy for them. It's not like you're going, oh, how can I make fun of this person? You're going, how can I reveal this person?
How did you start working with, you know, the crew that you made for your consideration with Christopher Guest, Harry Shearer, Eugene Levy, et cetera?
I think in 1991 or 1992, I auditioned for a movie called The Coneheads that Lorne Michaels produced. And I met Lorne Michaels, and I knew that I wouldn't get the part of Connie Conehead, but I thought that she should have friends. And I convinced Lorne Michaels to give me and my friend Joey parts as Connie's friends. And he did. And then a year or so goes by, and I get a call over a Christmas holiday. I was down south in Laurel, Mississippi, and to audition for a recurring part on Murphy Brown. So I got to fly out to L.A. and audition for the recurring part on Murphy Brown, which I did not get. But within that week, I met Christopher Guest. And Christopher Guest had called Lorne Michaels and asked him if he knew anyone who could improvise. And Lorne Michaels had recommended me. And Chris met me and Reese Witherspoon for the part of Libby May Brown in Waiting for Guffman. And I basically just sat down with Chris for about, I don't remember, half an hour, 45 minutes. And he says he can get a sense of whether people can do this kind of work or not.
You've been called by a lot of people, you know, like Queen of the Indies, Queen of Independent Films.
Oh, I love how you say that.
What?
Yeah, say it again. You're like Queen of the Indies.
So
I know, it's so silly.
Well, how did you start getting into independent films?
I went to SUNY Purchase for acting school, so I was doing student films there. And it was around when I left in 91, that was kind of when the whole independent film movement started. And I met Hal Hartley, who also went to Purchase. And my first job out of college was a soap opera called As the World Turns. And I had worked with Hal, and then I got cast in Rick Linklater's Days of Confused. And I was just around New York at that time. You know, now, with the community in New York is like, you know, the UCB and improvisers. Back then, in the early 90s, there was an independent film community. And I was around doing readings of scripts of directors and writers. And I would go out to L.A. and audition for something and not get it, or get an independent film while I was out in L.A. that shot in New York for like 25, you know, days or something. So it's just kind of where my life was leading me.
When you started making independent films, did it hurt your indie cred to tell people that you'd worked on As the World Turns? Was that something that you told people about or not?
I think it's really cool that I worked on a soap opera.
What did you learn from working on a soap opera?
How to take naps.
Mm-hmm. Wait, did you not have a big part?
Well, you would wake up incredibly early, and you'd have a 7 o'clock rehearsal, and then you may not work until 11 o'clock. So I would get a full face of hair and makeup on, and my wardrobe, and put on two robes because it was freezing, and then I'd get into bed and just like go back to sleep. So I learned how to relax in between as I was at work. And also, the material is so hard to do because a lot of it just doesn't make any sense, and there's a lot of exposition. And you learn how to work under pressure. And you couldn't even, if something was bad and you're like, whoa, I barely even, got that line out. Like, they would air it. And so then you go like, okay, now if I want to do that again, I have to like curse or something to get them to do it.
Be like, they couldn't run it that way.
Yeah. And it was, sometimes some of the directors would let me have fun with it and kind of make fun of it at the same time as I was doing it.
Well, this bed that you napped on, was that a bed on the set?
No, it was in the dressing room. And there were these intercoms that would, they'd call your name out over the intercoms. And then you'd go downstairs and then you'd act with another actor who like slept on his face. And so like he had like these sleep wrinkles on one side. You're like, wow, late night, huh? And then you'd switch places with him so that the other camera wouldn't see his sleep wrinkles.
That's really funny.
And he'd been on the soap since he was like 5 years old. But you get some really good stories. I was amazed at the actors there. So early in the morning, and then they're just kind of walking through it, and then by the time you get in front of camera, Colleen Zenk, who played my Aunt Barbara, would turn to me with a face full of tears. And she'd be like, where did that come from? It's a certain style that they're really doing, and some people are really good at it.
My guest is Parker Posey. She's starring in the new film comedy For Your Consideration. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Parker Posey, and why don't we listen to another scene from one of your movies? And this is from Kicking and Screaming, which was a 1995 independent film. And you play a senior in college. Your boyfriend has graduated, and he's hanging out with a group of guys who don't have much in the way of jobs or prospects. But he's been taking classes again. And here's the scene.
Make me sad, Skippy. This big idea about you learning and coming back to school and taking all these classes. You haven't done a stitch of reading since you've been here, and you get on my case about my studies. I mean, really.
God, I begged you to stay on Prozac.
You used me to come back to school. That's what you did.
Because I could care less about your stupid classes. Is G.I. Joe a safe doll to give kids at Christmas? What's the effect of TV weathermen on society?
My classes. Let's talk about your classes, okay? Your dinosaur classes and all that. Let's talk about your friends. Let's talk about how you guys are all in love with each other and how sick you make me with your stupid games, those trivia games. Ding, Max loves Grover. Ding, Skippy does Otis. Ding, they all do each other and it drives me nuts. Ding that, Skippy. Get a life.
Nice dime store psychoanalysis.
You know what? I can't stand you. I can't stand that. You know, your shoes, your pants, that shirt you're wearing, your hair. Your hair drives me crazy. Just get out, okay? I have homework to do. Just get out. Get out. Get out. 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 Go.
That's my guest Parker Posey in a scene from Kicking and Screaming. Do you think in the 90s, when you were making a lot of independent films and you were really becoming known for those independent films, that there was something that was called like a Parker Posey role or a Parker Posey type? Did you become identifiable in that way?
Yeah, I did. And I remember someone told me that I was like an adjective, and I was really hurt. I was in an elevator at Sundance, and there's another actress, and she goes, "You're like an adjective." Yeah, there was. And then there were other things that I would read, like, or someone would say, like, yeah, there's a part in a script for a Parker Posey type, and I would not have heard what that script was or what them. I wouldn't have gotten asked to do it.
So what was a Parker Posey type?
I guess sassy and funny and...
kind of eccentric.
I don't know. Funny, yeah.
And kind of, like, funny sexy? Like, sexy, but in a comedy.
Yeah, I guess. It's so weird. You know, movies now really shy away from the women being funny, and you get, like, you read scripts, and you're up for something, or there's talk about you, and, you know, this guy comedy, he already has a girlfriend that, you know, I'm not going to play, but... there's like another part for a funny girl, and they always end up getting cut. Those parts get cut, and that's the Parker Posey type that I would have been right for.
The kind of role that would get cut.
The friend.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, it seems like, you know, for many people, but for young actresses, that independent films have such more variety in the kind of roles they offer than the big, you know, like multiplex movies do.
Mm-hmm.
Did you find, I mean, did you ever wonder, like, if you'd gotten started in the multiplex kind of movies, where would you have fit?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was heartbroken when I didn't get the part in Reality Bites.
The Janine Garofalo part. Mm-hmm.
I was told that I got it, and then I was told that I didn't have it, and I was devastated. But, you know, as you get older and you see that your career, you know, takes its own shape and you have your own path that is really not up for you or your will or what you want, there's like a certain kind of design to it. And, you know, in the periods that I'm not working, I'm learning or I'm thinking about things, and... you know, these parts come to me. So I don't know if there hadn't been an independent film movement where, especially now, I mean, where I would fit in. I'm really grateful for that time. I feel really like I was a part of something that was really great.
I think one of the great things about a lot of the independent films, particularly like when you were getting started, is that, you know, many of them were much more literary than you could find. By literary, I don't necessarily mean about books, but the writing was just like really sharp. There were smart people talking to each other, so the dialogue wasn't just like a lot of witty retorts. Take a film like Day Trippers.
That was
so well written and performed, and its characters, you know, it's a family, and there's, you know, someone in publishing and someone who's a wannabe playwright, a little pretentious. And do you have a favorite scene from that film?
I think when Mom passes out, we had such a good time on that movie. Like, Anne Meara could barely say anything without me just laughing in her face. And Lee Ev and I are friends. We've done like 3 or 4 movies together. And Greg Mottola is just so lovely and smart. There was one scene where Anne Meara goes running out of the car, and she passes out. And I say, don't go into the light, Mom. And Liev was like, I was like, Greg, I want to say that line. And Liev was like, oh, God, don't say that. And I'm like, what do you mean? It's funny. He goes, oh, don't do it. And then, like, the movie came out, and Liev was like, you were right. You got a really big laugh.
How did you know that you were really right? Fun. You know, it's so easy to be talked out of something.
Right? I was like, just let me say it. I had so much more confidence then than I do now.
Is that true? Why is that true?
You just don't think that much when you're young. You don't think that much before you speak. And your instincts are usually better than anything you can really think about. But what else did I... You know, that movie was like a 7 or 18 day shoot. And Greg Mottola hasn't directed anything since. And he went out to L.A. and, you know, directed some TV and got some jobs, thank God. But it's, like, really hard. That whole group of people, a lot of them got co-opted by the studio system. And, you know, people waiting for Julia Roberts to read their script in order to get their movie made. And then the $2 million movie became a $19 million movie. And it just kind of lost its place.
Parker Posey is starring in the new comedy For Your Consideration. She'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Bantam Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Women's Bodies, Women's Wisdom, and The Wisdom of Menopause by Dr. Christiane Northrup. From the dairy farm families who own Cabot Creamery, 5 generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com. And from TIAA Cref, serving the financial needs of those in the academic, medical, cultural, and research fields. Online at TIAACREF.org/greater good. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we listen back to an interview with the filmmaker Robert Altman. He died last night at the age of 81. Also, 2 contributors to the satirical newspaper The Onion read a couple of their articles. There's a new Onion anthology called Homeland Insecurity. And we continue our conversation with actress Parker Posey. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Parker Posey. She starred in many independent films, including Dazed and Confused, Party Girl, Kicking and Screaming, The Day Trippers, and Personal Velocity. She's been in 3 Christopher Guest mockumentaries, Waiting for Guffman, Best in Show, and A Mighty Wind. Now she's co-starring in Guest's new comedy, For Your Consideration. When we left off, we were talking about her success in the independent film world. I always think, like, the reward you get for being a really good actor or actress nowadays is that you get to carry a gun on screen. You get a big high-paying role, and you learn how to carry a gun. Have you ever, like, had to do the gun thing on screen, or have you been able to avoid all that? Yeah.
I was in Blade 3. I don't know if you saw this film, Terry.
Blade 3, I did not.
It's a vampire film. It's part of the vampire trilogy that Wesley Snipes is in. And, I show up on set, and it's just a bunch of people, like, pow, 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 you know, a bunch of guys, like, and then we're going to, and they start, like, play fighting. You're like, it's like a 11-year-old. It's funny and charming, but, like, you can't believe that money's being spent like this. And so then they're like, and here you have a gun. And I got to hold a gun. I got to be a vampire. And which was kind of fun, you know. And I wore teeth and I had the fangs and the eye contacts. And sometimes I felt like I was in a B movie, and sometimes I acted like I was, and sometimes I didn't. You know, it was like.
Well, after.
And some people come up to me, some people love it, you know. Like, yeah, you were really hot in Blade.
Yeah, oh. No, you were in Superman Returns, and you played Lex Luthor's girlfriend. So what's it like after being on, like, so many independent films where you're cutting costs wherever you can and doing these, like, quick shoots to suddenly, you know, to be on one, or like, a really big movie like a Superman film? What are some of the differences in the way things are done? And, you know, the shortcuts that you have to take to save money on an indie film versus the way things is done on, say, a Superman set.
Yeah, when you have $200 million, you're going to time out your work in a particular way as a director and as a whole, like, group of people. So there was, like, 800 on the crew in Superman Returns. 800 people we shot in Australia. And on an independent film where you don't have a monitor and the director standing by camera and you have 20 days, you don't have a lot of takes and you really have to think about your shots and you have to time it out. So I'm used to doing takes, being good in the first, like, 1, 2, 3, 4 takes, and then, like, take 4 to 7 will kind of be like, I wasn't even there, I don't know. And then maybe by 9, something else starts to happen. When you do a big budget movie like Superman Returns, you're waiting around for, like, you could be waiting around for the entire day for Bryan Singer, who's very talented, to figure out optically what he wants this image, particular image, to be and how much weight it's going to have. So it's like, you know, it's dealing kind of like a comic book reality. And it was like going into a huge costume dock. You know, the costume department on Superman Returns, we got to come up with a whole story of this woman and down to her shoes. You know, I don't want pointed shoes. I want round-toed shoes and just this kind of look. So you get to be creative in areas that cost, like wardrobe on these big movies, or look or design. But there's also something, there is a stress factor that is present when you're making a $200 million movie that's not there when you're making a, you know, $1 million movie.
Is the stress passed on to the actors?
Mm-hmm.
How? Like, how did you feel the stress?
You know, there's a certain amount of protection that you have to get ready for when you're working on a Hollywood movie, or can get in the way of creativity. I mean, that's the thing with, like, with Christopher Guest's movies. He puts so much trust in the actors, and he just lets them go off. And when someone's kind of allowed to go off, who's, you know, talented and all that, it's just like so much more comes across. There's so much more that's revealed. And sometimes I think with money, there's so much pressure and so many people kind of watching what you're doing that it can be a little withheld.
Let's talk a little bit about your life. You grew up in Mississippi. Tell us something about where you grew up.
Well, I was born in Baltimore, Maryland. My dad was stationed in Vietnam. And he left for that. He got drafted when I was, like, around 1. I'm a twin. And so we lived in Baltimore till I was, like, 3. And then we went down. My mom when my dad was in Vietnam, drove home to Shreveport, Louisiana, where she was from. And then my dad got back, and we lived in Monroe, Louisiana. And I was part of, that's where I started dancing, and Linda Lavender's School of Ballet. She was my first ballet teacher, and kind of like the first kind of thing where I was like, this is what I want to do. I want to be on stage. And my dad worked at a car dealership for his uncle, Truman Van Veckhoven, in Louisiana. Has all these Cadillac dealerships. And he got offered a job in Laurel, Mississippi. And when I was 12, we moved to Laurel, which is a tiny, tiny town, much smaller than Monroe. And there were like 8 girls in the ballet class. So it was kind of a sad time for me. But North Carolina School of the Arts was doing some kind of thing in Jackson. And I took a class with them, and then I applied for their summer program, and I went there for ballet, and then I tried to get into the ballet department for school, and I didn't get in, and my dad called the dean of the school and said, what do I tell my daughter? She's going to be really upset. And he said, tell her she's an actress. So it was then when I started acting. And I had been told that before, but it always kind of embarrassed me. I'd been told by teachers, because I was kind of a ham, kind of, you know, a daydreamer. My parents thought I had a learning disability, and I was always just kind of head in the clouds.
So when the ballet, when the person from the school who turned you down said, tell her she's an actor and not a dancer, did he actually see acting potential in you, or is he just trying to make you feel better?
I think he was serious. Yeah, he was like, we almost accepted her personality alone. Like, I was such a, like, teacher's pet, I guess. I was loved, you know, the freedom that, you know, these schools are amazing, like Interlochen or NCSA, these programs where you can, as a kid, be around other artists. I was thrilled. And so, yeah, when he said, you know, tell her she's an actress, it made sense to me at the age of 12. I said, that's it, you know. But my parents were always, like, observant and kind of, you know, like, really, you know, eccentric people. And I was always kind of observing my surroundings, 'cause it's kind of, there's a lot to observe in the South.
Well, Parker Posey, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. I hope I made sense.
Parker Posey is starring in the new comedy For Your Consideration. Coming up, 2 contributors to the satirical newspaper The Onion read a couple of their articles. This is Fresh Air. The satirical newspaper The Onion has a new anthology called Homeland Insecurity, collecting articles from late 2004 to the end of 2005. My guests are 2 members of The Onion staff. Joe Garden is a writer and the features editor. Joe Randazzo is a writer and assistant editor. Joe Randazzo, Joe Garden, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start by asking you to each read a thing or two that you wrote. This new Onion book includes The Onion's, you know, quote, coverage of Hurricane Katrina. Do you have a favorite from the post-Katrina coverage in The Onion that you'd like to read for us?
Sure. Actually, we had a story that we ran about 3 weeks later, and it was Bush to appoint someone to be in charge of country. Washington, D.C. In response to increasing criticism of his handling of the war in Iraq and the disaster in the Gulf Coast, as well as other issues such as Social Security reform, the national deficit, and rising gas prices, President Bush is expected to appoint someone to run the U.S. as soon as Friday. During these tumultuous times, America is in need of a bold, resolute person who can get the job done, said Bush during a press conference Monday. My fellow Americans, I assure you that I will appoint just such a person with all due haste. The cabinet-level position, to be known as the Secretary of the Nation, was established by an executive order September 2nd, but has remained unfilled in these intervening weeks.
Joe Randazzo, your turn to read another submission that you wrote for The Onion.
Sure, this one is called 10% Tip Teaches Waitress Valuable Lesson. Concord, New Hampshire, where I'm from. After receiving subpar service and experiencing an unusually long wait for his $4.75 lunch at a local beefside family restaurant Monday, customer Gus O'Connor opted to give waitress Carla Hyams a reduced 10% tip in an attempt to communicate his dissatisfaction and raise awareness of the areas in which he felt her performance was lacking. Hyams, 49, who had been serving tables at the popular eatery for 13 years, expressed enthusiastic gratitude for the immense personal growth the gesture will afford her, adding that in the long run, the experience will make her a better waitress. Maybe I was a little short with him when I told him to hold on a sec, but in the future, I'll do my best to ensure a situation like that never, ever happens again, said Hyams, who put O'Connor's order slip in as the understaffed cooks dealt with a large, complicated meal for a busload of senior citizen tourists. It's days like this that I thank God I get paid less than minimum wage and can rely on a built-in economic incentive to keep me motivated during those 16-hour double shifts. Hyams added that she now knows she should always bring a glass of water without any ice cubes every time someone orders a Diet Coke, and that the phrase, when you get a minute, is in fact a polite way of indicating that the customer wants his request filled in under 1 minute. If he hadn't withheld that 50 cents, I'd make these same mistakes over and over for the rest of my career, she said. Even at my age, it's amazing to think you can still learn something new about a low-paying, menial labor job.
That's really funny. Have you worked it as a waiter?
I have. I did that for one summer.
Really?
Yeah, and that was enough. But it was just, I had to stress so much over, like, Reuben sandwiches, you know? It wasn't worth it for me, emotionally, to be a waiter.
How did you each first get into The Onion? Did you just send things over the transom?
I started in 1993, so nearly 14 years ago. I knew when I was in Madison, Wisconsin, I loved The Onion. I was a big fan, and I knew everybody. I knew some of the people that worked there. And so I was just sitting in the liquor store I worked at, minding my own business, where I was making signs for the window, which were, they started out with a product, like a beer, and then it's like a little joke at the bottom. And then there was a sort of an equilibrium struck with the beer and the product and the joke taking up equal space. And then it became almost all joke and no product at all. And finally, one of the, I just did it for my own personal benefit so I wouldn't go crazy working in a liquor store. And the assistant editor at the time, Dan Weber, came by and asked if I wanted to, said he was a big fan of the signs and wanted to know if I was interested in contributing to The Onion.
And Joe Randazzo, how'd you get started at The Onion?
Through doing some improv comedy here in New York, a young lady in my class named Amy Berrydale was in the position that I currently occupy at The Onion. And then Amy left to go to India for a while. And when she left, she suggested me for the job, which I thought was very sweet, but that I would have no chance. And then Scott Dickers, the editor-in-chief, sent along a story or two for me to test edit and called me and left a message on my voicemail telling me that I had a job at The Onion and I was working at a fruit basket company at the time.
Oh, and I forgot you were.
Yeah, so I left. I got this call on Thursday and then I started on Monday. And still paying the bar tab from that weekend.
Can I ask you each to read something that's a favorite of yours, a favorite headline or story from The Onion? Joe Randazzo, you want to read a favorite?
Sure. So this one's great. It's titled, Long-Awaited Beer with Bush Really Awkward, Voter Reports. Warren, Pennsylvania. Although respondents to a Pew poll taken prior to the 2004 presidential election characterized Bush as the candidate they'd most like to sit down and have a beer with, Chris Raynard lived the hypothetical scenario Sunday afternoon and characterized it as really uncomfortable and awkward. Raynard, a father of four who supported Bush in the 2000 and 2004 elections, said sharing a beer with the president at the Switchyard tap gave him an uneasy feeling. I thought he'd be great, Raynard said, but when I actually met him, I felt really put off.
I'm glad you wrote that. I always wondered for the people who said that they were voting for one candidate over another because they'd prefer to have a beer with them. Like, did they really think they were going to have a beer with either of them? And Joe Garden, I'd like you to read one more of your entries.
Okay. The article is called National Gonzo Press Club Vows to Carry on Thompson's Work. Las Vegas. During a Tuesday press conference at the National Gonzo Press Club, members of the nation's foremost organization of gonzo journalists vowed to carry on the mission of its founder, Hunter S. Thompson, who took his life last month.
Now that the whore beasts and the scum-sucking degenerate rat bastards in Wall Street and the White House are hell-bent on turning us all into pliant, scripture-muling puppet slavies, we must take up Hunter's fallen colors and charge into the fray, said NGPC President Gene Zolonga, who was a national affairs and shark-hunting editor for the Philadelphia Inquirer.
That's funny. Did you follow Thompson?
I don't know necessarily that I was a huge Hunter S. Thompson fan, but I admired the fact that he was a character. You know, he had, he was a very singular person, and that is something I found very admirable.
Well, thanks for reading that. Thank you both for talking with us about The Onion and for reading highlights of the new Onion anthology, The Onion Presents Homeland Insecurity. Thank you, Joe Randazzo and Joe Garden, for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks, Terry.
Joe Garden is a writer and features editor for The Onion. Joe Randazzo is a writer and assistant editor. Coming up, we listen back to an interview with the filmmaker Robert Altman. He died last night at the age of 81. This is Fresh Air. The filmmaker Robert Altman died last night at the age of 81. He was famous for his ensemble casts, working improvisationally with actors, and for pioneering the use of overlapping dialogue. His movies include MASH, McCabe and Mrs. Miller, The Long Goodbye, California Split, Nashville, The Player, Gosford Park, The Company, and A Prairie Home Companion, which was written by Garrison Keillor. Altman was awarded an Oscar for Lifetime Achievement earlier this year. I spoke with him in 1990 and asked how he auditioned actors.
When I audition, I don't read scenes, have people read. I'm not, usually the kinds of films I make are not dependent on that the dialogue is not the most important part of what their obligation is. I try to get a feeling for the person themselves and what they seem capable of and how they approach a project or a character. And I rarely have I had sat down and had someone read a scene for me.
You know, I have this image of the director wanting to see how a camera sees an actor, how an actor looks on screen, which is often very different from how they look in real life. Can you see that in your head without having to actually shoot the person?
My eye, that's what I do. I mean, I kind of that's what my job is to be able to anticipate that. I've been wrong, but not very often. I mean, I know of actors that started and never worked. It was the same way Jeff Goldblum, Keith Carradine, Michael Murphy, Shelley Duvall, Cher. God, there's an endless number of people who have more or less started in films of mine, and I don't think there's any case where I actually read them. I just don't know how to do that.
Does an actor have to be a certain kind of actor to work with you?
Yeah, I think so. I have had times where I have worked with actors who I know are good actors. I mean, really good actors, because I've seen their work on film or on stage. I've seen what they can do, and I hire them, and this doesn't happen often, but it has happened. And suddenly I realize I'm talking to them, we're ready to do a scene, and I realize they don't understand, they're not getting it. We're on a different communication track. They don't understand what I'm saying, and they're frustrated, and they don't do well. And I don't know what to do about that. When that happens, it's just a shame, because it's as much my fault. It's not their fault. It's half their fault. But it's just, you know, we meet people in the course of our lives that we just don't connect with for some reason. And we can't explain it, but there's something, there's some reason we don't understand one another. And that happens occasionally.
I'm thinking, too, of do you feel you can work with an actor who likes to do lots and lots of takes and have a precise performance, something precise in their head? Because I know you like to do a lot of scenes that are part improvised, that are comparatively loose, and that just might not work with a character who wants to keep doing it till an actor who wants to keep doing it till they get it just right.
Well, but the question is, what is just right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, whose decision is what is just right? The most extreme example I've had of that, what you mentioned, was in McCabe and Mrs. Miller. Warren Beatty is an actor who he was wonderful in that film. I can't imagine anybody being better. But Warren he would still be doing takes if people would stay there and shoot it. He doesn't start rehearsing until the third or fourth take. You have to run film through the camera, and it's like putting his toe in the water, and then his foot, and then he's up to his thigh. He tests it until he finally gets very, very comfortable. Well, that's fine if you have the time and money to do that, but in McCabe and Mrs. Miller, most of the scenes he was doing, we were working with Julie Christie, who, on the contrary, likes to do it in one take, and she'll do another one, but you can actually see that she starts losing her concentration or her confidence as the repetition goes on. So I had a big problem. I mean, Warren kept getting better, and he does get better, and Julie kept losing it. So where do you stop?
So what'd you do?
Well, I stopped in what I always considered was the middle.
So probably nobody was happy, right?
Yeah, well, there was frustrations.
Mm-hmm. Do you think of any of your movies as artistic failures? Are there any that you've made that you're unhappy with looking back?
No. I say that because it's kind of arrogant. But I don't have... The only film that I don't recommend to someone who has that thinks they may want to see it, I did a portion of a film called Aria. A bunch of film directors did little opera, I guess opera videos, and they were put together, and I did mine, and what I did was all right, but the way the whole piece was put together, I thought I'm sorry I did it. But all the other films are exactly what we set out, we meaning the collaborative artists that were involved in it. They're all what we set out to do, and whether a thing works commercially or not really doesn't have much to do with it. I mean, that's a matter of luck, time. There's certain films I've made that have failed at the box office and failed with the critics, and I understand why, but some of those same films have a cult following, and there's people who love them. Here, all the films that people want to make are films that are to serve an existing marketplace. That's why you see all the numbers after the titles, 2, 3, 4, 6, you know, sequels, because everybody's trying to find what it is that people want to see and give it. And I think that in an artistic medium, if there is any art left in this, the artist should do something, and then it should be exposed, and people either respond to it or they don't. But I think we've made too much of a business out of it. I don't think the audience now gets a true someone's true feelings or inspiration about a subject. And in most cases, it's tested, and they say, oh, they like this kind of an ending. They don't like that kind of an ending. And I can't really concern myself about what it is, what kind of an ending it likes. I made a film called Quintet with Paul Newman that nobody liked. I mean, it was really a failure. That picture lost money, not a lot, but it did. And yet in Europe and in the United States, there are little cult groups that just, that's the movie. So, and as long as I can find that cult, and a cult, you understand, is not enough people to make a minority, that pleases me, because that's what I'm trying to do, is just show, hey, look at it this way. This may not be the truth, this may not be, but this is the way it appears to me.
Film director Robert Altman recorded in 1990. He died last night at the age of 81. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross. We're closing with music from the soundtrack of Robert Altman's film, The Company.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Sir Arthur Conan Doyle's Complete Sherlock Holmes, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carpenter Company, maker of bed pillows and other innovative products designed to help people sleep better. Z-score test and sleep tips available at carpenter.com. And from the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the new Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan. Information at moma.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Many of the scenes from the HBO series The Wire come from the life of Ed Burns, a former cop and teacher who serves as a writer and producer on The Wire. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Burns about his experiences on the street, in the classroom, and on the set. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.